Our project now is to understand, or try to get a little feeling for, what in the world was the church doing while the Nazis were burning Jews? Is that a fair question? I mean, where were they, right? What was going on? What was the church's response to the Nazi state? I've given you a few hints about Bonhoeffer's response and some other people in the Confessing Church. But the primary thing we're going to talk about now is the Confessing Church. And then I'm going to give you, you'll see where we go. Okay, first thing is to understand confession. Okay, confession has a double meaning, A and B. Confession means that to fess up. Okay, did you steal it? Yes, I stole it. The Confessing Church said, we are guilty. Martin Niemöller spends 8 years in Dachau. He gets out of Dachau and he says, I am guilty. Do you feel that? Do you have a sense for that? It's a group of Christians who are saying, as German Christian citizens, we are guilty of what happened in our country, of what is happening in our country. We confess we are guilty. Now, Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler were not making confessions of guilt, okay? But some people were saying, we are guilty. And those people were in the Confessing Church. They were confessing their complicity in the crime. The other understanding of confession is that when you're backed up against the wall and you will not back up any further, you make a statement of confession. I will not back up anymore. This is a status confessionis. It is saying that we have been pushed back far enough and the gospel will not allow us to retreat anymore. It's at this point we must stand. This is evil. The gospel demands us to say it's evil, and we are making a confession, and we're telling you we're telling you the truth, okay? This is our confession. The Augsburg Confession is B here. This church in South Africa today is making a confession. That is, it's not going. It cannot back up anymore. It can't stand it anymore. It has to stop and say, the gospel forces us to maintain its position. So it's confession of complicity in the crime and not being able or willing to back up anymore. The Confessing Church. Congregations or so in the Confessing Church. It started as a movement, as an unofficial group of people angry, and it grew to an official church with official, an organizational structure. Like a lot of protests, it starts with feelings, and then it gets organized, and somebody starts to take minutes, and they elect a president, and all of a sudden it's an officially organized protest. Let's understand church-state relationships in Germany at the time, for all the whole relationship of church and state in general. There was a separation between church and state, but they were very close ties. For example, if I was a pastor in Germany, my paycheck would say the German Federal Republic on the top of it. Okay, my paycheck comes from Berlin. The offerings that we take at church go to the state. Then they recycle the money and send it back to me, just like a postal employee. There was technically a separation of church and state, but it was a very, very close relationship. Salaries, for example, were paid. Pastors were civil servants. Seminary training happened where? I already mentioned that.
University.
At the universities, okay, with 1 year as an internship following. It was technically not a state church, but the ties were so very close that it really couldn't be delineated. One of the dimensions of the church-state relationship is something that is called, what was happening was cultural Protestantism. This really applies to much of America too. Cultural Protestantism. That is, everyone's a Christian, aren't they? Right? It's sort of like Minnesota, all over the world. All over. It's everybody is a Christian, right? I mean, that's a nice, dangerous assumption to make. Cultural Protestantism, a Christian nation, that there was no conflict between church and state. Larry Rasmussen has some friends from Germany, and they came, he had many friends in Germany. Some friends came to Washington, D.C. a few years ago and visited him in Washington, D.C. And these people went to church with Larry, and they walked into church, and they saw the American flag next to the altar. And they were just absolutely astounded. He said, how could you allow that? Yeah. Their sensibilities about church-state relationships, about the potential conflict between church and state, are so keen that they saw that national flag next to the bread and wine, and they were just offended, whatever country it was. See, their own experience had taught them the subtle, and not so subtle, dangers of the confusing of symbols between church and state. So the flag, anyway, Larry just tells that story. But they were, the Church of Germany at the time was very comfortable with that whole experience, that there was cultural Protestantism. Everybody loved Bach, and everybody sang about Jesus, and everybody was a member of the church. The main parties now that operate in the resistance to the German, to the Nazi experience, is first a group called the German Christians. The main parties, there are four. The first is called the German Christians. These people were crude at best. They said that the goals of Adolf Hitler and the goals of the church are really the same. Okay. The German Christian church was never very powerful, but they were so obnoxious that they gave clarity to the issue. Okay, I'll read some quotes later on from the German Christian Church, the leaders of the German Christian Church. The next group is called the Lutheran Council. By far the biggest group in Germany at the time, the Lutheran Council. Their position was that the church and the state were separate and neutral. There was to be a standoff between church and state. The first group had them married. The second group had them out as a standoff. The third group is the Confessing Church. And the Confessing Church said that the state was in such gross disrepair and so evil that it was our job to work against it. Okay. Three phases. First, now we're going to look from 1933, that's the year Hitler was elected, until 45, until the war was over. We're going to look at three different time periods in there. The first from 33 to 35. During these years, the Confessing Church, now think just 100 congregations, think in some cases only the pastor, the congregation wouldn't go along. In some cases think 50 people in the congregation, but the pastor wouldn't agree to join. If you've been through the Missouri Synod struggle about whether to join the AELC or whatever, you know the kind of the subtleties or the not so subtleties of that whole kind of tension. Will your church join the Confessing Church? Will it not? The pastor does, but the council won't. The council will, but the pastor won't. All that kind of tension and stuff back and forth about what are we going to do. It starts as a movement. The charismatic movement has no publishing house early in its history. It just is a bunch of people doing it. Okay? Later on, it gets organized. This starts as a movement. No publishing house, no stationery, no letterheads. Just whoosh, goes. Okay? Later on, it gets organized. These first few years are the movement stages. Let's see. May of 1934, the key document for the confession... The Confessing Church is written. The key document is called the Barman Confession, B-A-R-M-A-N, the Barman Confession. It has six major points. It's written by Karl Barth, who's a Swiss pastor, later to become a dominant theologian of the 20th century. Six points to it. After writing the Barman Confession, Karl Barth lost his job as a professor at one of the universities because he was a state employee. Then, that was May of 34. In October of 34, the Dahlem Confessional Synod is established. D-A-H-L-A-M, the Dahlem Confessional Synod, where the Confessing Church was actually established as a church. At the Dahlem Confessional Synod, it was said that the confessing Christians owe no allegiance to the national bishops. You know who the national bishops are? That's obvious. The national bishops are the Nazi bishops. Okay. The confessing church says, we will not follow you. We will not obey your orders. Bonhoeffer was a part of both the Barmen Confession and the Dahlem Confessional Synod, and was a part of that whole experience. From 33 to 35, the resistance that the confessional church was offering was a resistance movement within the church. There's three stages. I already gave it away. This is resistance within the church. This is resistance outside the church. And this is both within and without, this time period here. See? Here they're working inside to change it. Here they don't know what they're doing. Here they're so outside that they've established their own organization, the Confessing Church. That will do. It was during this second period that Finkenwalde was established, okay? Life Together, during the second period where they weren't sure whether they were in or out. It was in this last period that the confessing church here was like a catacomb. That's the best analogy for the years from 37 to 45. The purpose of the Nazi state here at this time is to suppress the confessing church, to eliminate it. Early on, they start using legal matters, legal techniques. They get judges to pass certain rules. They have propaganda, and they hire hoodlums to beat up pastors or whatever, or anybody they can find to beat up. Later on, those pressures increased until 37 to 45. They don't hire anymore. They don't hire thugs to beat up people in the confessing church. They just send in the SS and their Mercedes Benzes, and they take care of it. It's nice and official and clean. One organization in all of Germany resisted the Nazi state. Not the doctors, not the physicians, not the lawyers, not the Arts and Musicians Guild. Only one organization resisted, and resisted cleanly and decisively. To the end. By the time the war was over, the Confessing Church was essentially gone. They were all gone. But the only organization that resisted from beginning to end was the Confessing Church. We're going to talk about the theology of Nazism. I mean, it was obvious that this whole experience was a religious experience. Is that... You want to ask any questions about what I've done here so far?
What was the... You said there are four main parties?
Oh, yeah. The fourth party was an organization called the State Church Commission. The State Church Commission was established by the Nazis to blend all these three together. In other words, to get them together. The Church-State Commission. And I didn't mention that because I just wanted to skip some stuff. Okay, what's the theology? What's the faith system? The theology of the Nazi experience. At the heart of Nazi... Do you understand what I'm saying about Nazi theology? I mean, this whole thing worked because it was a faith thing, right? The rallies were worship. I mean, they had their chants and their incantations and their prayer and their God, and the whole thing swept the nation. And so what we're going to do is look at, in just a minute or two, we're going to look at the key theological understandings of what Nazism was, and then we're going to look at Christian theology real quickly and see how it compares and why they were obviously in conflict. At the heart of Nazi theology was nihilism. Nihilism essentially says that at the center of life, nothing means anything. It's sort of a... The only thing that counts, since there is no meaning, there is no moral order, there is no right or wrong, the only thing that counts is sweat. Struggle. The meaning of life is struggle. Now that may be... I think there's some times when I think that there is no right or wrong anymore. There is no moral order. Who is... Is there anybody, is there anything to which we are accountable, or is it all just struggle? You know, is the essential meaning of life sweat? The Nazi theology of nihilism said at the heart and core of life, struggle was the issue. The goal of Nazi theology, the goal of life as a Nazi, was survival. Okay? The key word in nihilism was struggle and will, with a capital W. You maybe have seen this film. It was done in 1943 by a woman named Leni. You've seen it?
Yeah.
Reeves? Leni? Yes, Riefenstahl. Yeah, I couldn't remember. And it's a film, 1943, about the whole Nazi experience. I saw it on the Today Show recently. Oh, no, a public television. And it's an hour-long epic about glorifying the Nazi state. The title of the film is Triumph of the Will. Okay? She selected absolutely the perfect title to describe the Nazi theology, Triumph of the Will. In this situation, where this was the theology, the salvation meant struggle as a clan. Salvation was never personal in this system. Salvation was always corporate. The nation, that is, the tribe, or the ancient blood ties, or the kin, were that group was the meaning of all existence. So Hitler, along with Goebbels, creates the myth of Nordic tribalism, it's called. The German individual did not really exist. The German individual existed only so much as your blood and your soil were a part of the tribe. And together we struggle. You get it? Okay. In order for this system to work, for this theology to work, it needed an enemy. It needed an enemy for two reasons. First, a very practical reason, someone to fight against. But the second reason is that this theology did not permit sin, confession, or absolution. There was no sin in the Nazi theology. So what explains problems? If there is no sin, see, and if you're not responsible for any of that, what explains your problems? Something has to explain why your life doesn't go perfectly well. The answer? The enemy. Who is the enemy? The Jew. And the Slav, and blacks, and a few others. Gypsies. That's why you're not having a good time. And that's why things aren't going quite as well for you as they could. That's the enemy. A whole culture buys this theology. Not stupid people, mind you. I mean, these are highly, highly refined, technologically talented music. I mean, all the gifts of the world are here. This experience has got to convince us of the power of the devil. I mean, if anybody says that evil isn't real, I have never read history. You know, this is obvious, most clear-cut example. Salvation now. Okay, if the enemy is crucial, what is salvation? Salvation. Is cleanliness. Salvation is cleanliness. How do you get clean? You get clean by getting rid of the enemy, the dirty ones. You not only clean your house, but you clean the country. When you clean the country, all that life was meant to be will come true. All the flowers will bloom, the trees will grow, the harvest will come in, the cities will be good, and the schools will be perfect when the state is clean. Now, over against that is Christian theology. So the theology of Nazism the distinctions are rather obvious, that at the center of meaning, the center of meaning is not nothingness and sweat. The center of meaning is God, and that God comes to us and creates the world and acts on our behalf. Okay? The Nazi theology just thought that was just nonsense and didn't care for it at all. That at the center of the universe there was a moral order to which we were responsible. They did not agree with that at all. And that all of us were infected with self-love, that we sinned, that confession and forgiveness was necessary. Sin was simply not a part of an acceptable understanding of life as far as they were concerned. So they understood the Christian faith to be, first of all, too pessimistic. Talking about self-love and sin was just, they thought that was just really sort of disgusting, that it wasn't optimistic enough. That,
Nihilism is optimistic?
Well,
they didn't call it nihilism.
No, they didn't call it that. No.
That's just retrospective.
Pardon me?
That's just in retrospect.
Yeah,
right. Would classify it.
Yeah, yeah. And that it was, they also thought that the Christian faith was too quiet. That we waited, the people waited on God, when in fact the people needed to bind, the clan needed to bind themselves together in struggle, as opposed to waiting on God's action. Okay, that was another response. They also said that the tribe, the clan, is the ultimate value system. There is no value system outside of the clan, and etc. Now, that gives just a little picture of some of the theological differences between the two. The relationship that the Nazi state had to the church was one of tolerance and welcome and glad to have you around. You're a nice, harmless group of people and have a good time, but just mind your own business. For example, Article 24 of the Nazi platform is this. We demand religious liberty for all religious confessions within the state, insofar as they do not endanger its existence and do not offend the moral sentiment and the customs of the German clan, race, as it's translated. But they start out at least by saying everybody's welcome as long as you don't offend our German theology, our Nazi theology. Religion, the Nazis assumed, had to do with life after death. The Minister of Religious Affairs in 1934 said, religion has nothing to do with the practical affairs of life. Okay? Religion must always stay out of politics. And of course, in a totalitarian state, politics is everything. Right? I mean, where you live, where you work, the food you get, all that is related to politics when you're living in a totalitarian system. So they say the church must stay out of the state's business. The state's business is health, education, welfare, employment, recreation, everything. 1933, Hitler writes, we have brought the priests out of the party political conflict, and we've led them back into the church. And now it is our desire that they should never return to that area for which they were never intended. Okay? Just stay religious and stay in church and everything will be fine. During the war, Albert Speer was designing post-war Berlin. He was an architect and he was making drawings of what the city of Berlin would look like. The post-war city of Berlin had no real estate for churches. Okay? Because the church would of itself be eliminated after the war was over. The immediate aim of the Nazi movement was not to destroy the church, but rather to keep it in its place, in its spiritual place. Later on, it invaded the church's territory. It controlled the church by two methods. The first was to control the outside. The outside activities. Now that means that the Nazi state passed rules about retreat centers, about pilgrimages, about rallies, religious rallies,
about church-sponsored hikes, of which there were many. All those things were outlawed. These were outside of the realm of the gospel. Okay? They started by limiting the perimeter. Then they went to the heart and core of the matter, and that was the second stage. The second stage was to go inside, and they did that by controlling diocesan newspapers and other journals that were used. The Gestapo attended church, and they filed official reports on any special offerings that were taken and sermons that in any way made reference to the state. They also did it by melting down church bells.
Okay. They started by taking care of the externals, like you can't take your youth group on a hike, and then they proceeded to go to the internals, like attending worship services. Now, we ask, we're I ask, a little self-righteously, or say, well, if somebody tried to tell me I couldn't go to a rally, I'd protest that. You know, I'd really if somebody told me I couldn't do that, I would be really offended, and I would fight against that. Karl Barth makes the point. He said, when the state is attacking your core, you let them have these things. Okay. You can't fight them all over. When they're after you here, then you let that pass. Okay.
A little quotation from Karl Barth. The church, like man, has not only a soul, but also a body, without which he can have no soul.
Body, soul. You get it? Okay.
Read it again. The church, like man, not only has a soul, but also a body, without which she can have no soul. And if the church struggles against this death by strangulation, she defends her body for the sake of her soul. Okay. And then, later on, I guess I'll get to that. I got ahead of myself. Later on, he will say, Karl Barth will say, yes, we gave up certain things, but we had to go to the core to defend that. How does the Nazi state deal now? This is a general description of how they dealt. With the Roman Catholic Church, the Nazi state signed something called a concordat. What's a concordat?
A treaty.
A treaty, okay. With Roman Catholicism, Hitler and the Pope signed this agreement. I don't know much about that. What I want to talk about is what they did with the Protestants. There were 18 territorial churches. Now, this is the Roman Catholic solution, is the concordat. That's a separate issue. The Protestant people had 18 regional churches. In other words, there was the Seattle church. It was all a part of one church, but it was a regional thing. Seattle church, and then there was the San Francisco church and the Los Angeles church, and etc. It's obvious. The national bishop over all of these people is an appointee from Hitler, and his name is Ludwig Miller. Ludwig Miller's job description was break down these 18 regions and form one church. He failed at it, never did work. From these 18 regional groups, there were 100 congregations. And there were two of these 18 regional churches who formed together the Confessing Church. 16 of them did not join the Confessing Church, but two of them did, along with 100 congregations. What percentage of the total church population that is, I have not been able to figure out. A small part. For 6 years now, the Confessing Church, that is two of the regional synods plus 100 congregations, for 6 years, they held their own conventions, they trained their own pastors, they have their own money, and they really coexist with the Nazi state. Bonhoeffer runs this illegal seminary. It's illegal, but they tolerate it for a year and a half. Then they get put on more pressure. But the Confessing Church is allowed to stay alive during that time. The weapons that the Nazis used against the Confessing Church are some I've already mentioned: propaganda, edicts, court edicts, sanctions, you may not travel out of this particular province or neighborhood, and then violence, official or unofficial violence. How would you respond? Let's just say, well, for example, on the street corners and on large billboards, there were posters that said, "German youth, confirmation is silly, dumb, unnecessary. Come join the Hitler Youth Movement." Okay. You're a parent. All the kids in the neighborhood are wearing special shirts, and they're going to Hitler Youth meetings. Now, how do you respond as a parent? Okay. Or as a member of the congregation in a situation like that? Do you get a feel for the problem you've got? Initially, they responded to that sort of stuff with protests, letters, debate, etc. A lot of people protested. That was the first level of resistance. But now, there came a second kind of pressure. First, it was just propaganda. Now, they start passing court orders. If you do this, you're going to go to jail. Okay. If you tear down this poster that invites all the youth of your neighborhood to the Nazi youth meeting and it criticizes confirmation as an unnecessary thing, if you do that, you're going to spend 30 days in jail. Okay. It's one thing to write a letter. It's something else to go to jail for 30 days. Fewer people did that. The third level of response that the Nazis had to the Confessing Church was just plain violence, beatings or imprisonment for long terms. And how do you respond to that? So at one level, you know, I wouldn't have any problem writing letters, you know, or joining, you know, if we were all mad at the Nazis because we didn't like them. You know, we'd all be mad and stuff. But then what if would all of us go to jail for 30 days? Okay, that's the next level. Would all of us go to jail for a year? That's another level of resistance. This statement. People resisted not because they were courageous, but because they were clear about what was happening. Okay. Those who resisted did so not because they were exceedingly courageous, but because they had a gift of faith called clarity of what was actually taking place around them. Clarity, not bravery. The sin that preceded cowardice was confusion. Okay? The virtue that preceded bravery was clarity. The clarity was not an intellectual clarity. The professors gave in. The universities gave in. The labor unions gave in. It wasn't brains. It was a different kind of clarity. It was a faith clarity. You follow that? It's a big difference. And for me, that's the most important thing I'm saying today. That the heart of the resistance was not bravery. The heart of the resistance was not courage. The heart of the resistance was a faith-given clarity. Apart from intellectual information. We look at three responses that the church had, and we're borrowing here Reinhold Niebuhr's typology: Christ of culture, Christ and culture, Christ against culture. Three responses. The Christ of culture is the German Christian church. Do you remember me talking about, okay, you got that? These were the crude people, okay? These were the people who said that Jesus and Adolf have the same thing in mind. And Adolf is bringing in the kingdom. Larry Rasmussen says that the Christ of culture people were effective really only in 1933, the very year Hitler was elected. They were not effective very long. They were so crude and rude about the whole thing. They said that history was the source of revelation, that this was the new kingdom coming. The German bishop that Hitler assigned made this statement: "We recognize in the great events of our day a new commission of our Lord to his church." Okay. That was a guy named Mueller. Mueller's successor was a guy named Zollner. Mueller's successor, I don't know his name, put it very crudely when he said, "Dr. Zollner and Bishop Galen have tried to make it clear to me that Christianity consists in faith in Christ as the Son of God. That makes me laugh. True Christianity is represented by the party. The Führer is the herald of the new revelation." Okay? That is crude. Okay? Most Lutherans and Reformed pastors were extremely offended by this crudity, and it was ignored and not very effective. Never really significant after 33. But the effective group was number two. Those were the biggies. Christ and culture. Here, there is no conflict between the church and the state because the church and state operate in completely different realms. The state orders the kingdom of man, the church orders the kingdom of God. The state runs life, the church prepares us for heaven. It's the two-kingdom theory of Martin Luther taken to absurdity. Luther's idea that there are two kingdoms, the kingdom of this world and the kingdom of the church, the kingdom of the state, the kingdom of God, that's Luther's theology. The Nazis take it and they push it out to the extreme, or at least the Nazis don't take it. The Christian people of Germany take Luther's theology and push it to the maximum. They read Romans 13, obey the authorities and render to Caesar the things that are Caesar. They read Romans 13 about how we're supposed to obey the state. They do not read Revelation chapter 13. Sometime read Romans 13, then flip to Revelation 13, and you'll see the contrast. Okay, they read one, but they never read Revelation 13. The pastors and priests did religious things, but they avoided political things. Okay. Most German clergy held this view. They were not afraid or weak. They simply believed that to go against the state was improper. Okay, with a capital I. And that's the word that was used all the time. It was improper to protest. Christ and culture. Christ against culture. Third option. This is the confessing church. The conflict with the church and the state is inevitable because the church has overstepped its bounds. The state invades the church must respond. Over against contemporary events stood the judgment and the grace of God. This was attested to not in history, but in the scriptures. The confessing church said, history is not what, we don't go by history, we go by the scriptures. Okay? Our final test is the Bible, not what's happening historically. The Barman Confession says this. Barman Confession, remember, 1934, written by Karl Barth primarily. 6 points, one of them says this. Jesus Christ, as attested for us in the scriptures, is the one word of God that we hear, that we have to hear, and which we have to trust and obey in life and in death, is the one word of God. In other words, our own historical experience, the clan, blood and soil, is not revelation. Now this debate, Christ of culture, Christ and a Christ against, you understand this is a, number one is a small group of crazies, they don't last long. Number two is by far the greatest group. Number three is the confessing church. Two of the 18 synods and 100 congregations. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Niemöller, Karl Barth,
Hans Lilje.
Hans Lilje has been here to the village some time back. Now, some personal examples, and I'll ask you what you'd do. Let's just say you were a pastor. What would you do? Would you urge your church to join the confessing church or not? Maybe I just read the examples and you think to yourself. What would you do? Would you go to your church council and say, I think we ought to join the CC bunch? Or should we stay with the Christ and the culture bunch? Go with two or three. What Mueller, the Hitler's head bishop, sends out a letter. This letter must be read in all churches in the land. You're the pastor of the church. What would you do? Would you read Mueller's letter from your lectern? Or would you not read it? Okay. Would you pray on a Sunday morning during a worship service for colleagues who were in prison, knowing the Gestapo was taking notes on your worship service and filed them the next day on Monday morning? What would you do? A member of your congregation is a member of the Nazi Party and they are killed in action. What would you do at the funeral? What would you say? Okay. Would you attend Think Involved Seminary, knowing that if and when you graduated, your call would be to a church that was essentially penniless because their federal funding had been cut off, and that you and your family, if you had any groceries, you'd live only on what folks gave you, and you'd probably have no cash income. Would you be one of the 25 young men that went to this outfit and did that? Would you hide Jews in your house? Would you resign from the church in order to save your job? You got a wife and four kids, you know. If you quit your job, there's no welfare. See, there's no other job to get. But in order to keep your job, you have to quit the church. It's an issue that people are all over the world face all the time. You know, it's nothing new. It's just that it happened here, and it happens in People's Republic of China and Soviet Union and elsewhere, of course. Would you take a loyalty oath if you were a public school teacher? A loyalty oath to the state. Okay. Are these current questions or what? Good heavens. Here are a couple stories. Carl Steinbauer, 1936. He was a 24-year-old pastor. He had a wife and one child. Carl Steinbauer refused to ring the church bell after the annexation of the Rhineland. He was put in jail for 1 week. 1 year later, he tore down a Hitler Youth poster which criticized confirmation classes. He was ordered by the Gestapo to leave his parish and by his bishop to leave his parish. He refused. He was jailed for 3 months. When he got out of jail, he preached against the Nazi state the following Sunday. He was arrested and spent the next several months in jail. Later, he was sentenced to prison camp for 1 year. His wife and child were at home. Released, he was sent. At the end of the war, he was still in prison. He was in prison for 9 years or so. He was awaiting trial at the end of the war, 1945. Carl Steinbauer was awaiting trial for a sedition charge, preaching against the state. Because he was drafted, put in the army, and conducted worship services, and preached against the state to the soldiers. So he was tried on sedition charges, treason. A fellow named Carl Scoville, who has written an article in Catalogite from which much of this information is taken, visits Carl Steinbauer, and Steinbauer tells Carl Scoville this. He says this: I never bought the two-kingdom theory, not even in seminary. I knew I must serve God, not people. Okay? The two-kingdom theory. Luther's two-kingdom theory is very functional, and it's got a lot of good to it. It just was pushed to the absurd. Another true story. That's Carl Steinbauer, another guy. Paul Schneider. Paul Schneider was the first pastor to die in opposition to the state. He refused to leave his parish or to stop preaching. He was tortured and starved, and in his prison cell, which was near the parade grounds, he chanted Bible verses to the other prisoners who were out in the courtyard getting exercise. Julius von Jahn, V-O-N-J-A-N. He protested the Kristallnacht. He protested it, and he wrote, "This is the seed of hatred that is once again being sown, and what a terrible harvest will ensue if God does not grant us genuine contrition." Julius von Jahn was put in prison. Kurt Gersten was a Lutheran pastor in Germany, and he sent regular and frequent messages to England and to Scandinavia about the death camps. Bernard Lichtenberger conducted daily prayer services in his Lutheran parish in the city of Berlin for Jews. Okay? There were 6,000 Jehovah's Witnesses in Germany during the 30s and 40s. 97% of the adult Jehovah's Witnesses in Germany were in jail at one time or another, had prison records. 97%. I mean, you can get irritated if they knock on your door, but you also have to say they got a lot of guts, okay? Offered an alternative to the consent and to the guilt. They offered an alternative because they had confession and forgiveness. The Christians were free and able to resist and to disobey because they were forgiven. It's so interesting. In 1945, there were the Nuremberg trials, right? Remember? The Nazi officers were brought in and they were tried. And they said, "Are you guilty or are you innocent?" And they said, "We are innocent." That's 1945, the Nuremberg trials. In 1945, there was another thing going on, and that was in the town of Stuttgart. And in Stuttgart, the confessing church gathered together and said, "We are guilty." You feel the paradox of the thing? At Nuremberg, the Nazis said, "We're innocent." At Stuttgart, the same month, the confessing church gathered together and said, "We're guilty." Is it a paradox or what? It's the what frees us from insanity is that our guilt can be confessed and forgiven from group insanity or from private insanity. Is that confession's a possibility? See? That's what I think anyway. The resistors bear witness to an order which transcends the apparently overwhelming world of political power. See? That's my last statement. The resistors bear witness to an order which transcends the apparently overwhelming world of political power. Now, that's an awful lot of stuff, and I didn't give you any time for it. But what I've tried to do now was to just paint a picture of the confessing church, of the options that they had, the personalities involved, the personal issues that they had to struggle with, how they resisted, who resisted, how many did, and so you get a kind of a feeling for church-state relations and the misery that it can cause you and me. Ask me questions or say anything to each other, could you please? I'm not very good at eliciting responses. I should work on that.
So what kind of questions do we need to ask in relation to our life in America today?
Well, are we Christ against culture, Christ and culture, Christ of culture? And what ways do we move and etc. Well, yeah.
Could you just briefly tell me what Christ and culture was given?
Christ and culture is that the church's business is salvation, the state's business is politics. They'll do their work, we'll do our work, we'll get along happily ever after. Parallel tracks. Let's just have a nice time. Well, it's much more fun because the state then blesses the church, you see. Mm-hmm. The state affirms the church.
Is that like the church putting on blinders?
Well, it can be if the state's acting up, if the state's fooling around. South Korea now. The Presbyterians in South Korea that are being thrown in jail and executed regularly. The whole struggle is church against culture or church and culture. what's going on in South Africa today with Status Confessionis and the Namibian situation is a perfect example of one church saying, you know, we have to be against the culture. There we have no choices.